Telegram Herald for Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, also known as IRIS. City Plots Housing Plan. Workforce housing shortage is getting worse, the study finds. Dubuque faces a lack of available workforce housing, and that shortage only will worsen if nothing is done. Local economic development officials told the Dubuque City Council this week. David Lyons, sustainable innovation consultant with Greater Dubuque Development Corp, called for the city to create a comprehensive plan to address the city's workforce housing shortage during a work session with council members. The session focused on the high demand and low availability of affordable housing in Dubuque, which is leading to extremely low vacancy rates and high home sales. If we've got a problem, it's only going to get worse, Lyons told council members. Whether you look at the lowest, the average, on the highest way to look at it, we are significantly off what the market should be generating if it's responding to workforce housing needs in Dubuque. A recent housing needs assessment conducted by East Central Intergovernmental Association found that the vacancy rate for single-family homes in Dubuque was 0.5% in 2020, while the rental vacancy rate was 9%. Lyons said that the low availability of housing and high demand is driving up the price of homes. The average sale price for a home was $212,684 in 2020. The average increased to $236,390 in 2021, according to the housing needs assessment. The number of properties sold increased in 2021 compared to 2020, while the number of for sale listings decreased. Lyons said that the housing shortage is exacerbating already high housing costs for Dubuque residents, with about 43.5% of residents now spending more than 30% of their income on housing payments. The shortage is expected to worsen over the next 8 years, Lyons said, that by 2030, Dubuque will need to add 1,192 new housing units in order to meet anticipated demand. But at the current rate, the community is expected to add an estimated 681 new units in that time. Even if we're going to do our best, we would be half short, Lyons went on to say. He presented a number of strategies the city could pursue to increase housing stock while also making home buying more affordable. One strategy would be expanding the use of tax increment financing to offset the cost of developing housing for middle-income residents, along with using TIF funds to provide financial assistance to residents seeking affordable mortgages. Not only do you want to bring the cost down of home development, but you also want to bring up the buyer's ability to afford those homes, Lyons went on to say. Lyons also suggested that city officials work more closely with developers to seek state and federal funds to assist with home development, and that the city market to developers to encourage them to construct workforce housing for middle-income residents instead of low- or high-income housing. Lyons stressed that the importance of the city maintaining and expanding available rental units by increasing enforcement on nuisance properties and developing a warning system for aging rental properties that may need maintenance or improvements. He also said that the city should work to curb the number of single-family homes being converted to rental units and suggested city leaders identify area of the community for potential apartment and multifamily unit housing. City Council member Danny Spranks said that the high demand for housing in Dubuque is negatively affecting the community by driving up costs and limiting availability of housing. He said that the council likely will discuss adopting a housing plan during goal-setting sessions scheduled for later this year. If the need for housing is on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 10, Sprank went on to say. We need to figure out how to attract more developers and find more land to build on. Councilmember Susan Farber said that the city also should focus on redeveloping its existing supply of vacant historic homes as a means of increasing the number of available homes. We need to try to find more investors to take these wonderful buildings and turn them into housing, Farber said. The more we can do to address the issue, the better. Chicago, most common origin for newcomers. Study finds young people moving into the area are more diverse than those who left. A new U.S. Census Bureau report shows that a sizable proportion of young adults in the tri-state area moved here from elsewhere and that they are more racially diverse than young adults who left. However, this group was too small to replace the number of young adults who grew up in the tri-state area but left. The study conducted by the Census Bureau's Center for Economic Studies and Harvard University tracked where people born from 1984 to 1992 lived at age 16 and where they lived at age 26. The report also shows where young adults who moved to an area came from. The study compiled data by commuting zones, clusters of counties deemed to have shared history of workplace commuters, Clayton, Delaware, and Dubuque, and Almaquy counties in Iowa, and Joe Davies County in Illinois are in one zone. Lafayette, Crawford, Grant, and Greene counties in Wisconsin are in the Monroe zone. Jackson County and Clinton County are in the Clinton zone. The new crowd. Of the young adults living in the Dubuque zone at age 26, 68% had grown up there. That rate was 67% in the Clinton zone and 66% in the Monroe zone. About one-third of young adults in each zone moved there from elsewhere. In the Dubuque zone, 4.1% of young adults living there at age 26 came from the Chicago zone. The largest group after young adults who already lived in the Dubuque zone at the age of 16. Other areas from which young adults came to Dubuque included the Monroe zone, 2.9%, Clinton, 2.4%, Rockford, Illinois, 2.2%, Waterloo, 2.2%, and Cedar Rapids, 2.0%. Nick Huckenberry, Workforce Programming Director for Greater Dubuque Development Corps, said that the organization has a five-year strategy to lure more young adults from some of those cities. That 26 to 36 cohort is prime for our marketing when it comes to our competitive advantages here, which are, we think, a great place to raise a family. We have great opportunities for professionals. We have a great quality of life. It's safe here, and there are good schools, he went on to say. Rachel Wall, who was born in 1985, is a social worker at the Sunnycrest Manor in Dubuque. After a nomadic upbringing in her Army family, she arrived in Dubuque in 2003 to attend Loras College. At Loras College, she met her new husband, who was from Dubuque. So she remained here to raise her two sons. We found pretty rewarding careers here, Wall said. I feel like Dubuque has been for us a great place to raise a family and to give my kids a chance to experience some diversity. Of young adults living in the Monroe zone at age 26, 34% moved there from another zone, mostly elsewhere in Wisconsin. 9% were from Madison, 3.2% were from Kenosha, and 2.1% were from Milwaukee. Some also came from the Dubuque zone, 3.3%, Rockford, 2.9%, or Chicago, 1.2%. In the Clinton zone, 33% of the people living there at age 26 moved there from elsewhere. 6.3% of the people in that age group were from Rockford, the largest group. Another 2.6% were from Chicago. Otherwise, the young adults who moved into the zone did so mostly from elsewhere in Iowa. Diversity. While the number of young adults moving into the tri-state area was less than the number of people leaving it, the opposite was true for people of color. In the Dubuque zone, 53% of the black young adults who were there at 16 also were there when they were 26. However, those who grew up in the zone made up just 17% of black young adults who lived in the Dubuque zone at 26, meaning 83% of the people in that group moved into the area. The same trend exists for Hispanic young adults and young adults of Asian descent. Of Hispanic young adults living in the Dubuque zone at 16.50% stayed, and they made up 46% of those there at 26. For those of Asian descent, 43% living there at age 16 stayed, and they made up 42% of those there at 26. In the Monroe zone, 35% of the black young adults there at 16 stayed, and they made up just 26% of the young of the black young adults living there at age 26. In the Clinton zone, 47% of the black young adults who were there at 16 stayed, and they made up 31% of those living there at age 26. In each of the zones, more white young adults left than moved into the area. The study said that young adults who were Hispanic, black, or of Asian descent were less likely to leave a commuting zone if that zone had a higher rate of their race in the population. Historically, the region has been pretty homogeneous, Huckenberry said. It makes sense that the ties to the community among diverse populations are newer. Those diverse populations are growing at a faster rate than the white population. Kelly Brown, director of Jackson County Economic Alliance, is trying to make her county more welcoming to people of all demographics. We are trying to start a grassroots effort to change the educational and social culture to one of overall acceptance for people as they are, as they strive for excellence in their own skills and abilities, she went on to say. Bringing them back. The tri-state area zones lost a significant net number of young adults in the period covered by the study. The number of people the Dubuque zone when they were at age 26 was 18.1% less than the number of people living in the zone when they were age 16. The number fell 24.4% in the Monroe zone and 25.1% in the Clinton zone. There is a problem, Hockenberry said. GDDC and its partners hope to begin to solve by bringing back young adults who left the area. The study verified for us that there's a lot to be gained from reaching out to persons, whether it's this young population who grew up or spent some of their formative years here, or people in nearby communities looking to them as potential prospects for returning to the community, he said. Ron Brisbois, executive director of Grant County Economic Development Corporation, said county officials have had the best convincing young adults who left the Monroe zone to move into the area. They get into their early 30s and the mentality changes, he says. What you're looking for when you just get out of college versus that of what you want when you're trying to start a family. Well, if you build it, they will come. Countdown to MLB at Field of Dreams. Businesses pitch baseball themes. From shirts to beers to menus, business owners are dreaming big. In Dyersville, Iowa, as Major League Baseball fans put on the finishing touches on their travel plans to the Dyersville area, businesses are getting ready to sell specialty items for the festivities. Businesses around Dubuque County will be selling products created for the MLB game at the Field of Dreams. The Chicago Cubs will play the Cincinnati Reds on August 11th in a minor league baseball game between the Quad City River Bandits and Cedar Rapids Colonels will take place 2 days earlier. I think everybody's looking forward to visitors, said Jennifer Recker, owner of the J&R Fashions and Haber-Outfitters Company in Dyersville. Tourists really love our town, and we love meeting people from all over the country. Becker's stores released 3 custom shirts for the game. In addition to selling the pieces in the stores, she will be selling them during Fan Fest and beyond, the game event taking place August 10th and 11th. One shirt features a silhouette of a baseball player hitting a ball and a cornfield with the phrase, "They will come." Another shirt is simpler, Becker said, with a baseball field baseball and the date of the Cubs-Reds game. The third shirt features the iconic Field of Dreams movie phrase, "Is this heaven? No, it's Iowa." We had people contacting us right away after the date of the MLB game was announced last year, Becker said of the property. "We were able to book it up, the game, right away. And I just got a bunch of requests on Monday wanting to be on the waiting list. I have a waiting list of about 36 people right now, if for some reason those people cancel last minute." Recker also added that the property, which she opened in March of 2021, also was full for last year's MLB game. "It's really the MLB game last year that really put us on the map as a destination place," she went on to say. "We've been booked out pretty much all of this summer." Several area brewers also have special brews related to the MLB game. Dimensional Brewing Company made a beer called Moonlight Graham Slam with Minnesota-based Back Channel Brewing Company. Dimensional co-founder and brewer Grant Wolf said that the name of the beer stemmed from Archibald Moonlight Graham, a baseball player and a doctor who was featured in the Field of Dreams movie. The beer will be sold at a Dimensional tent in downtown Dyersville on August 11th and 12th, Wolf said. The breweries also will be selling a cotton candy beer and a pickle-flavored beer called The Biggest Pickle, a reference to the movie The Sandlot. Wolf said Dimensional will have plastic 20-ounce baseball bat-shaped glasses at its tent. "We've always been very excited to be a part of the community, and I think that we do a pretty good job of having a pretty nice platform to celebrate different things in the community," Wolf went on to say. Textile Brewing Company in Dyersville and Dubuque-based Seven Hills Brewing Company also have Field of Dreams-themed brews. Robin Myers, owner of the Just For You in Dyersville, said that the business has rolled out custom-designed shirts and sweatshirts and tank tops for the MLB game, and it has been selling the items online. One design features baseball players standing in a cornfield, and another states, "Come for the field, stay for the dreams." Just For You is also selling custom baseball-themed ornaments, and the business also is working with Kendrick Home in Edgewood, Iowa, to sell custom signs at the Dyersville shop, Myers went on to say. Myers said that for last year's game, she made the decision to sell game-related shirts closer to the date of the event. "This year, we made a plan and have done pre-orders," she said. "We've had a ton of pre-orders from California to Ohio and Indiana. A lot of people followed our page from last year and saw them there." Russ and Jody Steger, who took over as owners of the Palace Saloon in November, will have special events and dishes for their customers. Jody Steger said that the restaurant will feature live music in the afternoon on August 10th and 12th. A portion of the street outside of the restaurant will be closed for the bands. The restaurant also will feature food and drink specials the week of the game, while the exact menu items have yet to be determined. She said that the meals will feature the smoked barbecue item for which the Palace is known. We're just excited to be a part of this event, she said. We just love seeing people get together and being able to meet new people. All right, let's turn to some other Dubuque and Tri-State area news. Bike rental program nearly ready to roll in Bellevue. In Bellevue, Iowa, the city of Bellevue soon will launch a community bike rental program with plans to expand the initiative as funding and resources permit. City Council members this week heard an update on the program, which likely will begin operations in the next few weeks. City Administrator Abby Scribseth said that after the meeting that for several years that the city has hoped to offer bike rentals. Funding from the Dream Bellevue Endowment Fund recently made the idea possible. We've had people ask about a bike rental program, as they're very popular in bigger cities, she said. With our increase in campgrounds and in the area where not everyone always brings their bikes, this will help spur some of the foot traffic. The city will offer 6 bikes at a rack outside the newly renovated Button Factory building located at 305 South Riverview Street. Residents or visitors who wish to use the bikes will download a smartphone app, enter credit card information for payment, and scan a QR code on the bike to unlock it. Rental fees for the bikes will begin at $1 for the first 30 minutes, with each additional hour costing $2. Skirfseth said that the fees will help the city cover the cost of annual software fees for the program, as well as any necessary bicycle maintenance. It's not going to be a very big revenue generator, but it's like a park in town, she said. You don't make a lot of money, but it'll be an attraction that tourists and citizens can use. The program will operate from spring through fall. Skirva said that the city eventually hopes to add another bike rack and additional bikes at the program. The city purchased 4 adult and 2 children's bikes for the program from local businesses, Blackwater Bicycle Shop. And she went on to say that the total cost of launching that program, which also includes software, locks, bike racks, and signage, was for a little over $7,000. Mark Rogge, owner of Backwaters Bicycle Shop, said that customers have urged him to offer bicycle rentals for years, but that the cost of renter's insurance always made the cost prohibitive. He said that the city's program will be a wonderful thing for both visitors and residents. The need is there, and there's a demand for it, especially since the big multi-million-dollar investments along the river offshore resort has been built. There's been a serious increase in people interested in cycling, Rogge said. It will be an asset to the community, even for people that live here and want to get bikes for their visitors. It's a win-win situation. And let's take a look at some other news in the Dubuque area. National Night Out aims to help open doors of communication in Dubuque. Eleanor Healy, age 5, peered over the backseat window of the police cruiser parked on West 15th Street in Dubuque under the watchful eye of her mother and police officer Mark Lorenzen. "Can you open the door?" Lorenzen asked jokingly. There being no interior handle, Eleanor could not. The Healys were among the many families who visited Jackson Park on Tuesday for the annual National Night Out, which promotes positive relationships between first responders and the community and allows children and parents to get up close with fire engines, ambulances, and police cars. It was the first time that the event, which has been held in Dubuque for more than a decade, took place in Jackson Park. The city chose to move the event in light of a planned redevelopment of Comiskey Park, where National Night Out has been held in the past. While some organizers indicated that the crowd in the news venue was a bit smaller than in the past years, the event was by most counts a success. The kids were all very nice, said Point Neighborhood Association President Sandy Plumley, known a royally known as royalty among the fellow organizers for her longstanding involvement with the event. It's fun to make the kids happy. Several residents of the neighborhood surrounding Jackson Park were pleased at the event's new venue. Comiskey Park is a central place, but it's good that they're going to every park, said Fred Davis, who lives on 15th Street. It's a smaller park, but there's a lot of kids around here, so it's good that they're coming here as well. Harper Francis, age 10, and Riley Conley, age 9, like meeting the police and first responders. Riley, a recent transplant to Dubuque, said that the National Night Out won out over her hometown's version of the event for the additional amenities. You get to go in the ambulance, Riley said. Harper and Riley were among event attendees who toured paramedic Dan Bulk's ambulance. Bulk also said that her favorite kids were ones who came with a lot of questions. Even better if they said that they wanted to be an emergency medical technician by the end of the conversation. But the first responders often face tough competition for kids' attention, particularly in the face of the several colorful bounce houses set up in the center of the park. It's a very competitive environment, Lorenzen said. I feel we held our own with the siren and the lights and the bars and the police cars. Asked what her favorite part of the evening was, Eleanor Healy responded definitively in favor of the bounce houses. I went on both of the cool ones, she went on to say. And fall is just around the corner. Doesn't seem possible, does it? But Halloween parade scheduled for return to Dubuque this fall. Ghosts, ghouls, and more will return to the streets of Dubuque this year with the resurrection of the annual Halloween parade. The parade will be held at 7 p.m. October 22nd as part of Julian Dubuque International Film Festival's Books and Brewers events. The two-day celebration also will include a scary movie screening in Washington Square and a brewfest. This will be in Julian Dubuque International Film Festival's first year being involved with the parade, which hasn't been held since before the COVID-19 pandemic in 2019. We felt that it's something that's great for the community and it'll fit with our goal of doing an October film event, said Festival Executive Director Susan Gorell. We're excited to bring back that wonderful community event that everyone can enjoy. The parade will follow its typical route through downtown Dubuque, with candy being thrown from floats and passed out to children along the way. Gorell said that she hopes to see plenty of movie-themed floats and music to align with the film festival's mission. Parade officials will post updates about the celebration online as they become available at julianfilmfest.com. Anyone interested in registering a float or band should reach out to Gorell at juliandubuquefilmfest@gmail.com by October 10th. And in some other news here, police, driver arrested after a high-speed chase. Police said a driver was arrested after leading authorities on a chase in Dubuque while traveling at least 55 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone and 35-mile-an-hour zones as well. Justin D. Harry, age 29, of 7865 Kane Road, was arrested at 10:34 p.m. on Monday at 9526 Massey Marina Lane on a warrant charging eluding and a speed of 25 miles an hour over the speed limit, driving while barred. Court documents state that an officer saw Harry driving at about 12:20 a.m. June 9th at the intersection of Loris Boulevard and Central Avenue. Harry was barred from driving until May 2026. An officer attempted to stop Harry, but he drove off through a parking lot on the White Street and accelerated to a high rate of speed, documents went on to say. The officer observed that Harry almost hit a marked patrol vehicle at 22nd and White Streets in the process. Authorities briefly pursued Harry on Kaufman Avenue before calling off the pursuit. Documents state that Harry was estimated to be driving 55 to 60 miles per hour on Kaufman Avenue. The speed limit on the street changes from 25 miles per hour to 30 miles per hour. You're listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for August 3rd, 2022, and I am your reader, Peter Welch, and we are with the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, better known as IRIS. Let's now take a look at today's obituaries. John C. Paisley, Reverend John C. Paisley, also known as Father Jack, age 86, of Dubuque, passed on the 31st of July. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. until 6:45 p.m. on Wednesday, August 3rd, at the Church of Resurrection, followed by a prayer service at 6:45 p.m. The mass Christian burial for Father Paisley will be at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, the 4th of August, at the Church of Resurrection, celebrated by Archbishop Michael Jackals and praises of the Archdiocese of Dubuque. Burials will be in Resurrection Cemetery in Dubuque. Otto F. Rabel of Galena, Illinois, has passed. He was a lithographer, a retired metalsmith, an executive, died Tuesday, the 19th of July, 2022, in hospice at Luther Matter Dubuque from complications of pneumonia. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that any donations in his memory be made to the Joe Davies Conservation Foundation, the Safe Haven Humane Society of Joe Davies County, or the First Presbyterian Church of Galena. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.furlongfuneralchapel.com. Karen N. Steffen, age 78, of Livingston, Wisconsin, formerly of Dubuque, Iowa, passed at 2:18 a.m. on July 30th. Visitations is at 9 to 11 a.m., with an 11 a.m. funeral service at Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, Wisconsin, on Friday, the 5th of August. Burial will be in Greenwood Cemetery. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyth, I'm going to spell that, melbyth.com. Mary Duchner, Sister Mary Benjamin Duchner, has passed at the age of 81 on Thursday, the 28th of July, at the Sisters of Presentation at Mount Loretto at 2360 Carter Road. Friends may call from 3:30 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, August 4th, 2022, at Sacred Heart Chapel. Sisters of the Presentation there will be a wake service at 7 p.m. The celebration of eternal life will be held on August 5th at 11 a.m., followed by burial services in Mount Oliver Cemetery, Key West. Visitors will be required to show proof of vaccination or wear a mask. And finally, Virginia Lammer, age 98, of Dubuque, passed on Friday, the 29th of July, at Stonehill Care Center. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home, and they're located at 2659 Kennedy Road. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Saturday at St. Anthony's Catholic Church, with Reverend Steve Roskiny officiating. Burial will be in Holy Family Cemetery. All right, let's turn to some other tri-state news here today. Innovative road materials sought for Clayton County. Hinson requests $4 million for soybean-linked proposal. A federal spending request by U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Iowa, would help pay for Clayton County roads to be repaved by asphalt made of a soybean byproduct. Hinson, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Appropriations Committee, requested $4 million for Clayton and Fayette counties to rehabilitate roads using an innovative material sourced from soybean oil instead of petroleum polymers. The spending package that includes her request has been advanced by the committee and the full House of Representatives and now awaits a vote in the U.S. Senate. Clayton County engineer Rafe Koopman said that the proposed routes for the project include 8 miles of Clayton County B-45 from Monona to Marquette and 4 miles of Golden Avenue from Farmsburg to U.S. 18. It's kind of an exciting thing to be able to use projects we need done here as the test of new material, he said. We've been working to get our roads prepped so it'd be easy for the contractor to come in and do the final stage of the project, which would be asphalt resurfacing. The patching on these roads and some culvert extensions have been the only funds Clayton County has spent on the project so far, as the funding has not been yet passed by the Senate. If Hinson's request is approved, Koopman said that he could begin work in summer of 2024. Clayton County is partnering on the project with Iowa State University, where the soybean pollinator was created. Eric Cochran is a professor at ISU's Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering and the director of the Center for Bioplastics and Biocomposites. He said that the material would be used in Clayton County is the result of 12 years of research and experimentation. This is a combination of how to showcase the technology, but also put it into practice on rural Iowa roads, which are often overlooked or don't receive enough resources to keep up to date, he went on to say. The material uses a polymer from soybean oil to replace petroleum-based polymers often found in asphalt and is designed to be used with recycled pavement, which Cochran said makes more environmental sustainable sense. It also provides another market for farmers' soybean crops, which soon could become less profitable as a biofuel, with the automobile industry moving more and more toward electric vehicles. It's important to have a broad portfolio of end uses for this crop, Cochran said. Right now, the soybean oil is very highly sought after for its fuel value, but there are a lot of industrial uses as well. No matter how much is produced in a given year, being able to satisfy food value and industrial demand is important. McDonough Foundation awards nearly $440,000 to area nonprofits. The James B. and Melissa A. McDonough Foundation recently awarded grants totaling $437,292.50 to local nonprofits. Foundation's board chair, Ann McIndoe, said in a press release that the foundation this year chose to focus on grade level reading on an area of interest when rewarding grants across the tri-state area. Community foundations of Dubuque, Jackson, and Clayton counties. Every Child Reads programs received a $75,000 grant, while Holy Family Catholic Schools received $50,000. Other organizations that received $10,000 or more were Dubuque Community YMCA, YWCA, Iowa Legal Aid, The Power of Prayer Incorporated, Camp Courageous, Clark University, Dubuque Regional Humane Society, Dubuque Visiting Nurse Association Foundation in Dubuque, Public Schools, Loras College Opening Doors, Riverview Center, and St. Mark Youth Enrichment. The McIndoe Foundation was created in 2013. Since that time, it has awarded approximately $4 million in grants to nonprofits in Dubuque, Jackson, Delaware, Clayton, Jones, Fayette, and Buchanan counties. More information can be obtained at McIndoeCharitableFoundation.org. Former head of Iowa Greyhound Group sentenced to 15 months in prison. The former head of Iowa Greyhound Association, convicted of illegally selling thousands of doses of controlled substances and misbranded prescription drugs, now is facing 15 months in prison. John Stidham, age 56, of McClelland, pleaded guilty in January to crimes related to the distribution of drugs for racing greyhounds. Stidham pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to deliver, distribute, and dispense methamphetamine, a Schedule III controlled substance, by means of the Internet, and without a valid prescription, and one count of conspiracy to introduce misbranded drugs into interstate commerce with intent to defraud. Last week, he was sentenced to 15 months in prison. Some of the drugs distributed by Stidham were to prevent female greyhounds from going into heat, prosecutors said, which allowed the dog's owners to continue racing them. In plea agreement, Stidham admitted that he operated a company called Kennel Supply, which was brick-and-mortar business that provided a variety of items used for the operation of kennels and the care of farm animals. Through the Internet, Kennel Supply also sold controlled substances and non-controlled drugs that require prescriptions. From 2015 through 2018, Stidham sold over 300,000 doses of meth, a controlled substance without valid prescriptions, generating profits of $324,303, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, during the same period. Stidham illegally distributed over 50 types of misbranded prescription drugs without a valid prescription, which allegedly generated $203,207 in profits. Court records indicate that the scheme involved a Kansas veterinarian identified in Stidham's indictment only as Dr. S, and an unnamed relative of Stidham, who acted as co-conspirator or co-schemer. Stidham used the Drug Enforcement Administration number and Kansas veterinary licenses of Dr. S without the vet's knowledge to order drugs, prosecutors allege. The drugs were then shipped to Dr. S, but at an address that had been provided by his unnamed co-conspirator, who then arranged for Stidham to pick up the drugs. Court records indicate that as far back as 2015, the Iowa Board of Pharmacy was aware of Stidham's conduct and had informed him that his actions were illegal. The board then provided Stidham with instructions on how to lawfully sell these prescription drugs and controlled substances, prosecutors allege. Despite that, Stidham continued over the next 3 years to sell controlled substances and prescription drugs while failing to follow the directives of the Iowa Board of Pharmacy, prosecutors allege. Iowa Greyhound Association operated Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque from 2015 until earlier this year, when the venue closed. In addition to being sentenced to 15 months imprisonment and ordered to forfeit $527,500 in drug proceeds, Stidham has been fined $7,500. He also must serve a 3-year term of supervised release after his prison sentence is completed. There's no parole in the federal system. Now let's turn to news to the nation and the world. News briefs. Russia brands Ukrainian steel plant defenders and terrorists. In Kyiv, Ukraine, Russia's Supreme Court on Tuesday declared Ukraine's Azov Regimen a terrorist organization, a move that could lead to terror charges against some of the captured fighters who made their last stand inside Mariupol's shattered steel plant. Russia and its separatist allies are holding an estimated 1,000 Azov soldiers prisoners, many of them since their surrender at the steelworks in mid-May. Russia authorities have opened criminal cases against them, accusing them of killing civilians. The addition of terrorism charges could also mean fewer rights and longer prison sentences, A terrorist organization leader could receive 15 to 20 years, and group members could get up to 5 to 10, according to Russian state media. Senate approves toxic burn pits bill in Washington. A bill enhancing health care and disability benefits for millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits won final approval in the Senate on Tuesday, ending a brief stalemate over the measure that had infuriated advocates and inspired some to camp outside the Capitol. The bill now goes to President Joe Biden's desk to be signed into law. He said that the bill makes good on our sacred obligation to care for veterans and their families. The Senate approved the bill by a vote of 86 to 11. The bill is projected to increase federal deficits by about $277 billion over 10 years. U.S. sues Idaho over abortion law. In Boise, Idaho, the Justice Department on Tuesday filed a lawsuit that challenges Idaho's restrictive abortion law, arguing that it conflicts with a federal law requiring doctors to provide pregnant women medically necessary treatment that could include abortion. The federal government brought the lawsuit seeking to invalidate the state's criminal prohibition on providing abortions as applied to women suffering medical emergencies, Attorney General Merrick Garland said. The announcement is the first major action by the Justice Department's challenging a state trigger law since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June. The court's decision has led some states to enact restrictive abortion laws and is likely to lead to abortion bans in roughly half the states in the U.S. U.S. approves massive arms sale to Saudi UAE. In Washington, the Biden administration on Tuesday approved two massive arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to help them defend against Iran. The more than $5 billion in missile defense and related sales follows President Joe Biden's visit to the Middle East last month, during which he met with numerous regional leaders in Saudi Arabia. Both Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been hit in recent months with rocket attacks from the Iran-backed Houthi rebel movement in Yemen. The new sales include $3 billion for Patriot missiles for Saudi Arabia, specifically designed to protect itself from rocket attacks by the Houthis, and $2.2 billion for high-altitude missile defense for the UAE. Pelosi arrives in Taiwan, defying Beijing. The U.S. House Speaker's visit ramps up tension between China, and the United States. In Taiwan, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late Tuesday, becoming the highest-ranking American official in 25 years to visit the self-ruled island claimed by China, which quickly announced that it would conduct military movements in retaliation for her presence. Pelosi flew in aboard a U.S. Air Force passenger jet and was greeted on the tarmac at Taipei's international airport by Taiwan Foreign Minister and other Taiwanese and American officials. She posed for photos before her motorcade whisked her unseen into the parking garage of a hotel. Her visit ratcheted up tensions between China and the U.S. because China claims that Taiwan as part of its territory. In its views, visit by foreign government officials as recognition of the island's sovereignty. The Biden administration and Pelosi say that the U.S. remains committed to the so-called One China policy, which recognizes Beijing but allows informal relations and defense ties with Taipei. The speaker framed the trip as part of a broader mission at a time when the world faces a choice between autocracy and democracy. Her visit comes after she led a congressional delegation to the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv in the spring and serves as a capstone to her many years of promoting democracy abroad. We must stand by Taiwan, she said in an opinion piece published by the Washington Post. On her arrival in Taiwan, she cited the commitment that the U.S. made a democratic Taiwan under a 1979 law. It's essential that Americans and our allies make clear that we never give in to autocrats, she went on to say. Taiwan and China split during a civil war in 1949, but China claims that the island as its own territory and has not ruled out using military force to take it. The Biden administration did not explicitly urge Pelosi to call off her plans. It repeatedly and publicly assured Beijing that the visit did not signal any change in U.S. policy toward Taiwan. Soon after Pelosi's arrival, China announced a series of military operations and drills, which followed promises of resolute and strong measures if Pelosi went through with her visit. The People's Liberation Army said that the maneuvers would take place in the waters and skies over Taiwan and include the firing of long-range ammunition into the Taiwan Strait. And now let's come back here to the U.S., to Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin's GOP legislative candidates outraising Democrats, group reports. In Madison, Wisconsin, Republicans running for the Wisconsin legislative easily raised more than money than their Democratic opponents over the first half of the year, according to a report released on Tuesday. Government Watching Group Wisconsin Democracy Campaign analyzed campaign finance reports covering the first 6 months of 2022. The group found that the Republican Candidate Committee and the two GOP-led legislative committees, the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee and the Committee to Elect a Republican Senate, raised $4.36 million. Democratic candidate committees and the party's two legislative committees, the Assembly Democratic Campaign Committee and the State Senate Democratic Committee, raised $3.11 million. Total fundraising by all committees range in at $7.47 million, eclipsing the previous six-month fundraising record of $7.12 million set during the first half of 2020. Republicans go into the fall election with a commanding majority in both the Assembly and Senate. The GOP almost certainly will maintain control of both houses, thanks largely to gerrymandering district boundaries. Also in Madison, Wisconsin, Michaels spends nearly $12 million on bid. In Madison, Wisconsin, Republican Tim Michaels has spent nearly $1 million per week for a total of nearly $12 million of his own money in his run for Wisconsin governor that began in late April. Campaign finance reports filed of next week's primary election show. Michaels endorsed by Donald Trump in the race where he faces former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish and State Representative Tim Ramthan. Michaels is a co-owner of Michaels Corporation, the state's largest construction company. Reports filed with the state on Monday show that Michaels spent another $4 million of his own money in July on the race, bringing his total spent so far to just under $12 million. Clefish has raised about $7.5 million total for the race since joining in on September, none of it from her own pocket. Rantham has raised about $189,000 total. The winner of the August 9th primary will advance to face Democratic Governor Tony Evers. He has raised $11.1 million through July, including more than $1.1 million last month. And now let's go to Chicago. Judge gives defense lengthy extension in Madigan case. In Chicago, the racketeering case against former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan and his longtime confidant will likely not see any significant court action until next year, after a judge Tuesday granted the defense a lengthy extension to review the massive pile of evidence turned over by prosecutors. And the first status hearing in the bombshell case in 4 months U.S. District Judge Robert Blakely set a February 1st deadline for the filing of pretrial motions, saying that he was granting the delay up front so defense attorneys wouldn't have to come back and ask for more time. Assistant U.S. Attorney Amarjeet Blako had asked for pretrial motions to be due sometime this year. The prosecutor in discovery was substantially complete in the case. Blakely set a status hearing for the 9th of January. And that does it for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald here at IRIS, which is the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, for August 3rd, 2022. I am your reader, Peter Welch. Thank you so much for listening.